May it please the Court, Brett Bendistis on behalf of the appellant Jose Neves. At this time, the appellant would respectfully ask permission to reserve 3 minutes of rebuttal time and would ask if the Court would like a brief resuscitation of the facts.
I think we're probably familiar with the facts from the
Excellent.
Briefs.
Thank you. The appellant in this case has brought a private civil action seeking damages from the appellee stemming from a real estate refinance of the appellant's primary residence. Specifically, the damages which are being sought are the recovery of fees that were required under the Mid-Atlantic opinion to be performed by attorneys, and furthermore, subsequent economic damages that were caused in a result of the attorney not performing those duties at the closing.
What were those economic damages?
Those damages were a subsequent refinance refinance of the property that had to be done to get out of the loan that was being done at the time. My client was unable to essentially make the right decision at the time of the closing simply because of, I would say, themes that are considered in the Mid-Atlantic opinion. You know, that it's referenced that a borrower in this type of situation, because it's so important, because it involves so much money and shelter, that it's easy to be, I don't want to use the word exploited, but at very least put in situations that are less beneficial because of inexperience, because of desperation, because of the need to get through it. He went through that process, and he had to get a second refinance on his loan to get out of the previous loan, which was not the terms and conditions which he had agreed of previously. It wasn't the bargain that he essentially had planned when it came to his procedure with the bank. It is specifically our opinion, just overall on the process, that my client is entitled to these damages along with the fees that were entitled to be performed by attorneys. It is overall our argument today that the Superior Court erred in not only the procedural aspects, the pleadings and the Delaware Consumer Fraud action, but the overall holding that in some way this case violates the Supreme Court's jurisdiction over the unauthorized practice of law, which we feel is an error. Specifically, the intersection between that and the Sherwood case. Now, the Sherwood case obviously reserves that jurisdiction to enjoin, to regulate, and discipline the unauthorized practice of law with the Supreme Court, and that's undisputed.
Well,
however,
how is your conception of what the law is or ought to be work in the system that we have? Take this case. Now, if you're correct that your point of view would not interfere with the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, the exclusive jurisdiction mm-hmm. of the Supreme Court, to regulate the unauthorized practice of law, then would it not follow that All-Star Title would have to be first subject to some proceeding before this court to have it found to have engaged in the unauthorized practice?
I would say no, Justice.
Then who is going to make that determination?
Well, I would say 2 points. That determination is based simply off the facts and the damages of a civil action. You know,
by
I would
whom?
Compare it.
Determination by whom?
By the Superior Court.
But the Superior Court doesn't have jurisdiction.
Yes.
To determine whether a party is engaged in the unauthorized practice. So, again, my question is, how does your theory work in the system that we have?
I would make an analogy in the sense of it's comparable to a civil action that stems from a criminal action. You know, person A is driving drunk and hits person B, damages his car, and breaks person B's leg. That person who's hit and injured is still allowed to file an action against person A, even though it involves criminal behavior. You know, I mean, they're still driving drunk. There's still a source of conduct that caused the injury. However, the civil court is not precluded from awarding damages based on if damages are proven, based on the fact of, you know, they don't have the authority to find him guilty of drunk driving. However,
well, that court has jurisdiction over both the criminal actions and any negligent or reckless or intentional act that could form the basis for a civil claim.
Yes.
Isn't that different than what Justice Jacobs was just asking you about?
I think that it's slightly different, but I think that it's still two different courts that have to make two different determinations.
Well, you know, this court has held repeatedly that we have the inherent and exclusive power to regulate the bar and determine the unauthorized practice of law. So to rule in your favor, wouldn't we have to go en banc and have this entire court overrule that prior precedent?
It is the appellant's position that you do not, for the reasons we set before. Simply put, that
remind me what they are.
Just simply put, that this action is simply asking to make a designation on the facts regarding damages and the conduct of the specific facts that were being done. If it requires the court to go en banc, then yes, it would require the court to go back and allow this specific determination to be allowed. Simply put, because it would, if that finding has to be made prior, then yes, I would concede.
Regardless of jurisdiction to find whether or not there has been an unauthorized practice of law, isn't your argument that under the consumer fraud statute, for a title company to come into the state and purport to handle the settlement, certify title, assist a buyer in obtaining financing, all of that is fraudulently done because they are knowingly practicing law, purporting to practice law to a consumer who doesn't know any better, and that's tantamount to committing a fraud. So that the real underlying cause of action is fraud, and the facts are that they practice law without the authority to do so. But the real jurisdiction lies in Superior Court under the Consumer Fraud or Protection Act.
Yes, I would agree that there is a certain jurisdiction that is reserved with the Supreme Court. However, I think that delineation between allowing either the Superior Court to make a decision regarding the unauthorized practice of law or referring it in any way to the Supreme Court.
In other words, your complaint is not seeking to stop All-Star Title from acting as if they were a lawyer in a state where they're not authorized to handle settlements.
That's correct.
You're claiming that their actions, which fraudulently constituted the unauthorized practice of law, proximately caused money damages to your client, and that Superior Court has jurisdiction over civil actions for money damages.
That's correct. It's our position that this isn't a matter of enjoining or regulating or disciplining. The most appropriate equivalent of Sherwood is the Mid-Atlantic opinion. I mean, Mid-Atlantic is the case of we're stepping in and we're regulating the profession and making sure that the act's done. I mean, both cases don't involve damages. They're both specifically contemplated that nothing's been presented that specific damages were shown. This is a case where we're specifically showing the damages that are being done, and we're only asking for that. I mean, we haven't asked for an injunction.
But going back to the predicate for that claim, mm-hmm. What you're saying is our court has already decided what constitutes the unauthorized practice of law with regard to real estate settlements. To that extent, we've opined, we've exercised our exclusive jurisdiction. Based on that clear, settled law, you have an action under the Consumer Fraud Act because you're alleging they violated our clear holding about who can practice law and who couldn't. And if they want to come in with a defense, we had a lawyer or something like that, maybe they can do that. But as far as our court's exclusive jurisdiction, we've already exercised it when we made our holding, and now this is simply an application of the holding within the act.
I would completely agree with that, Justice Holland. I would also state that there's an inquiry there that I don't think is incredibly difficult to make.
Well, before you proceed, let me see if I understand your answer. The predicate act that constitutes the wrong under your theories of recovery, whether they be the Consumer Fraud Act or something else, that is the common law tort, is the same conduct that would constitute the unauthorized practice of law. Is that correct?
I cannot deny that, no. Yes, that's correct.
All right. So if you label the cause of action as the unauthorized practice of law, then you run headlong into our precedents, which state that the Supreme Court has the exclusive jurisdiction to determine that. So it appears that what you're doing is calling it something else, fraud, common law tort, in order to avoid that having to abide by that procedural route.
Well, I tend to think that there's a reason for that. I mean, it's not just a matter of...
Well, yes, there's a reason for it, or no, I'm not doing that.
Well, I would say, I mean, inherently, part of the claim is the unauthorized practice of law. You know, part of it is stepping in and violating that opinion by having someone come in and do duties
that are...
Well,
it's essential. It's the sine qua non for your cause of action, isn't it?
Well, I would argue that the central part of the action is also the damages, and that's essentially...
But that doesn't... You don't recover those unless you have a mm-hmm. cause of action.
Then yes. It involves the unauthorized practice of law. However, the issue that, you know, the reason why we're here today is simply because by reserving this for the unauthorized practice of law, and this is just based on information and belief that if Mr. Neves brought this claim to the unauthorized practice of law, there may be an enjoyment, there may be discipline, but I don't know if he's able to get his damages back. You know, is he able to recover those fees that he paid? Is he able to get those thousands of dollars back that he had to pay on his equity to make sure that he was able to proceed with what he wanted from to begin with? You know, I mean,
let's assume, hypothetically, the answer is yes. Where are you?
If the answer is hypothetically yes, then yes, my client, with the existing laws that have proceeded so far, if he was able to obtain all the damages that he would be obtained before, then yes, then the exclusive jurisdiction is with the unauthorized practice of law. I would further argue that I think the practical application of allowing civil actions greatly outweighs than reserving it just for that jurisdiction. Simply put, because not only are you making a clear directive as to how people are able to recover these damages, you're giving people a path to take. It's not just Better Business Bureau, DOJ, going to attorneys who don't know what the rights are. But this is a clear, obvious determination that, hey, you know, this is what we're able to do. This is how you're able to get your money back. That way people have a clear right. They know what they're able to do.
Well, let me make sure I understand what the roots of your basic claim. Are you suggesting that there is a common law claim that can arise from the unauthorized practice of law that can be decided as a matter of fact what constitutes the unauthorized practice of law in a trial court that has jurisdiction to award civil damages when there is a common law tort? Or are you saying that under a statute of Delaware, this constitutes a consumer fraud, and that you can proceed under that Consumer Protection Against Fraud Act, or however one wants to characterize it? Now, if either of those is correct, what I think I understand you to be saying is the exclusive jurisdiction of the Delaware Supreme Court is regulatory in terms of stopping an entity from the unauthorized practice of law, but it's not the sole source of determining whether, as a matter of fact, someone has engaged in the unauthorized practice of law. Is that fair?
To answer your first question, we filed claims under both common law negligence, but also the statute. I mean, I believe that the strongest basis is the consumer fraud action, simply because of the type of action it is.
But inherent in either of those is your view that any court who has jurisdiction over the common law tort or that statute can make findings of fact about whether there has been an unauthorized practice of law, which do not involve enjoining it, disciplining an entity for doing it, or construing the regulatory power of the Supreme Court. Correct?
Based on the specific language of the Sherwood opinion, I would say that they would be able to do so, that they would be able to make that determination because they're not regulating, because they're not controlling the practice, but they're just simply making a finding pursuant to damages that they previously have the rights to do.
One could argue that from Justice Jacobs' earlier question, there's an issue about whether this court is the only entity in Delaware that can make a finding of fact about whether there has been an unauthorized practice of law. Do you agree or disagree with that?
To date, I would agree that that's the only thing that's on record so far, that yes, that the Supreme Court has to make that decision, but I don't think that specifically in this type of situation that the Superior Court is barred from doing that because, again, it's not the enjoyment or the discipline.
Well, just to follow up, I think the question was whether the Supreme Court has exclusive jurisdiction to make a determination, whether it be a fact or law, that a particular person is engaged in the unauthorized practice of law for all purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Your response is, no, the exclusive jurisdiction extends only or applies only for the purpose of regulation. Where the purpose is to recover compensatory damages, then there is no exclusive jurisdiction. So that's the issue okay. we have before us. Is that right?
That's my position on this, yes.
All right, well, then let's see how it works hypothetically. We know here we've decided the Mid-Atlantic case, and lawyers are supposed to conduct real estate settlements. So if you can establish facts that fit within that holding, you already know the answer from this court. In the hypothetical, we have a different situation, someone engaged in other conduct that we haven't addressed. Can the Superior Court examine those facts and, as a matter of first instance, without our court ever having addressed it, decide those facts constitute the unauthorized practice of law?
No, I would say that they cannot, because that would infringe on the duties that were set forth. The Superior Court in this case is simply following a directive that's done before. And on a practical sense, I would state that practically, I think that it wouldn't be a total decision to a difficult decision, I should say, in requiring a lot of analysis by the Superior Court to say this is the unauthorized practice of law.
But yeah, I think you lost me on the inconsistency there.
Okay.
If there is a logical divide between the exclusive jurisdiction of this court to mm-hmm. regulate the unauthorized practice of law by defining what constitutes the unauthorized practice of law in a particular situation and then regulating it by imposing injunctive relief or some stricture of one kind or another on the entity or person who has practiced law without the authority to do so, that's one thing. But factual findings for the purpose of a common law tort or an anti-fraud statute could be made in the first instance by any court that could make a factual determination that a common law tort or a statute had been violated. And that could be a wholly independent, without precedent, finding mm-hmm. that these facts constitute the unauthorized practice of law in a way that proximately caused proved damages that harmed a plaintiff. Now, why would there have to be some earlier determination by the Supreme Court that these facts constituted the unauthorized practice of law if it doesn't involve regulating the entity in some way and only involves whether or not there's a common law tort or a statutory basis for the imposition of compensatory damages?
Well, I think that in that case, you're reserving, again, that exclusive jurisdiction. You're making that issues of first impression, which is the point of Sherwood, is that, you know, it's historically been recognized that attorney conduct is regulated by the Supreme Court. I think that it wouldn't be a broad holding, you know, that this holding specifically would relate to this specific practice because of the type of damages that can be caused, because of the considerations that are put forth in Atlanta.
Today you're comfortable because you have, in your fact situation, your complaint, a basis for understanding that the Delaware Supreme Court has already said these facts constitute the unauthorized practice of law. But it sounds to me like your argument's inviting us to go much farther than that in terms of accepting that there can be a common law tort or a consumer fraud statute that encompasses any facts mm-hmm. that arguably constitute the unauthorized practice of law when someone's damaged by the unauthorized mm-hmm. practice of law in a way that would allow them to recover compensatory damages. That's where you started out with your emphasis on, well, damages make the difference here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think damages make the difference because there's a specific edict that says where, you know, the damage is caused. You know, if it's going too far, then I tend to think that the point is not specifically overarching for all unauthorized practice of law, but it's specifically for this fact because there is that edict before, that it's not regulating. I think that if the Superior Court had an action that was unauthorized practice of law and they were awarding damages, then that inherently would be greater to the point of enjoining, disciplining, regulating.
Well,
but this has already been regulated.
You're now at the point you have less than a minute for rebuttal. Did you want to stop now?
I'll stop now.
All right. Well, you have 43 seconds in rebuttal.
I'll make it worth it. Thank you.
May it please the Court. Art Arneo on behalf of All Star Title at counsel's table, Scott Chan. Appellant attempts to make four claims, and as pleaded, appellant's allegations failed to state a claim for any of them. As to the discussion earlier, there is no consumer fraud on these facts here because there's no material omission of fact alleged. There's also no proper intent alleged. There's also no negligence claim because even under Mid-Atlantic and any other case appellant has cited, there's no duty for a settlement agent to ensure that a refinancing borrower be represented by Delaware counsel. Instead, Mid-Atlantic contemplates prosecution of the alleged rule breaker before the board on the unauthorized practice of law. There's no contract claim because there's no contract. Superior Court asked and appellant produced what it claimed were contracts, none of which had any of the language alleged.
Well, I gather from the fact that you're leading off with these arguments that you're saying that we don't need to decide whether or not this action is barred because the Supreme Court has exclusive jurisdiction. We can decide the matter based on the deficiencies of the complaint.
No, I believe it is a matter for the...
I'm sorry?
I believe it is a matter for the Board on the Unauthorized Practice of Law. I was leading to that by getting rid of any other civil claims that...
Well, you're saying it isn't the unauthorized practice of law? That's not being pled here?
I'm sorry. I don't understand the question.
Do you agree or disagree with the plaintiff's argument?
I disagree.
Excuse me, that the exclusive jurisdiction of the Supreme Court to adjudicate unauthorized practice issues exists only for regulatory purposes, but not for purposes of awarding compensatory damages.
No, I believe it exists for all purposes.
Okay. Is that your primary position or your subsidiary position?
It is our primary position.
So your position is if some entity engages in the unauthorized practice of law and an individual is damaged economically as a result of that unauthorized practice of law, there is no opportunity under Delaware law to recover those damages against the entity who practiced law without authority.
Well, first, on the facts alleged, there are no damages. Basically, they don't have a cause of action under any
of the facts. Well, I understand that may be the answer to another question, but what's the answer to my question?
The rules on the for the Board on the Unauthorized Practice of Law allow the board to make recommendations to the court, which the court can either accept as sanctions, for instance, or not, and that goes before this court.
Are you suggesting that sanctions that could be imposed by this court could include an order to pay damages to an individual who was harmed by an entity practicing law without authority?
Absolutely, yes.
Wouldn't that expand the scope of an unauthorized practice proceeding in this court or under our court's rules?
Well, the process would be the panel would recommend, and the court could then say yes or no. The court could also, the panel could also recommend various other dispositions, such as after the question whether or not something is the unauthorized practice of law or not is determined, then the court could allow other causes of action at the civil court level.
Well, at the present time, if your lawyer is negligent, you can file a claim with disciplinary counsel saying my lawyer's negligent, he violated the rules of ethics. But you can also file a claim in the Superior Court for legal malpractice based on negligence. Why shouldn't it work the same way for the unauthorized practice of law?
Because the rules of professional conduct do not give rise to a civil claim. There has to be something extra. There has to be a common law parallel in order for that to happen. And just in that same vein, an alleged instance of the unauthorized practice of law doesn't give rise to a civil claim. They're both sui generis determinations and sui generis proceedings governed by standards very different from those in civil proceedings. They're just not civil claims, and they're not meant to be and never have been construed.
No, I understand that. The rules of ethics make it clear that they can't be a basis for the suit. But when we're talking about this court's exclusive jurisdiction to regulate the bar for ethical misconduct, no one disputes that. Similarly, no one disputes that if you have a claim for damages for legal malpractice, you can pursue that in the superior court, notwithstanding this court's exclusive jurisdiction to regulate the bar. So if someone takes money from you and says to you, I'm a lawyer, but they're really not a lawyer, are you saying that the person who pays a $5,000 retainer to a layman who misrepresents that they're a lawyer cannot go to some court and sue to get their $5,000 back?
They certainly can. But I believe the analogy is different here on the facts. The settlement sheet clearly omits any payment to a lawyer. There's no misrepresentation about a lawyer handling this proceeding.
But all that's done in the face of an understanding, isn't it, that in this state our rules require that a lawyer handle the settlement. And it may be that there are 48 other states that do it differently. But in this state, the Supreme Court says a lawyer must handle the real estate settlements. How could All-Star Title not know that when they came into the state and purported to handle a real estate settlement, which implicitly requires legal advice, without having a lawyer either attend or supervise the settlement to the knowledge of the buyer?
Your Honor, the mortgage that resulted was valid. They're not alleging that it was not. There are only certain situations where the mortgage would be invalid. So they've gotten the bargain that they've gotten the mortgage that they were looking for. There's no connection.
Well, let's assume that's true, even though your colleague had disputed it in his opening argument by saying because he didn't have a lawyer, he didn't get the financing he thought he was going to get and therefore had to refinance. Whether that's properly pleaded or whether that's factually true is not relevant here. But are you suggesting that we have a system where an entity can come in fully knowing that they have no authority to handle a settlement under the circumstances in this state, and that the only remedy is for this court to have brought before it an unauthorized practice of law complaint, which we then adjudicate and deal with sanctions, theoretically, if it's proved there was an unauthorized practice of law. But in the meantime, if a Delaware consumer is harmed as a result of that settlement, or pleads that they were harmed as a result of no lawyer being present at that settlement, there's nothing the system can do about it?
No, Mid-Atlantic directly addresses that situation and says this court has the exclusive jurisdiction to adjudicate those matters. That is, of course, a hypothetical, because on our facts, there was no connection between what is alleged as damage to the lack of an attorney pled. And so, just to say that was a hypothetical, but Mid-Atlantic Mid-Atlantic provides for this court to address situations like that and address damages as well, either as sanctions or by then allowing a civil claim based on other causes of action once the question of...
All right. Why would it be bad policy for us to articulate that, as Justice Holland described in the case of legal ethical violations as opposed to legal malpractice, the latter can cause to be instituted a complaint for money damages in Superior Court, the former cannot. It's exclusively within the regulatory power of the court. Why shouldn't a parallel, as a matter of policy, good public policy, why shouldn't a parallel universe exist for the unauthorized practice of law under these factual circumstances?
Because a finding at a civil court that Mid-Atlantic, for instance, was violated is a finding that something or someone committed the unauthorized practice of law. And once that's on the record, once that is enshrined in an opinion, then other courts can start interpreting that. And
well, with Rule 11 in mind, how could anyone file an answer in this situation contending that this was not the unauthorized practice of law? If it's pleaded and alleged that a title company handled the full ramifications of a real estate purchase settlement in Delaware with no attorney, how could you respond in an answer to the complaint under Rule 11 with Rule 11 sanctions in mind, anything other than admitted?
I believe at that point we would bring a motion to dismiss, but yes, we would have to.
Well, I mean, you brought a motion to dismiss on the theory there's no jurisdiction for the court to entertain the complaint. I get all that. My question is, as a matter of, we're talking about who appropriately determines the facts. But if there are no facts in dispute, why shouldn't we create a system where if someone does properly plead that they have been economically harmed by the unauthorized practice of the law, why shouldn't there be an opportunity to recover for civil damages if they can be proved in a court of law that has the jurisdiction to handle a negligence claim?
Because all of these claims involve the practice of law. There must be a predicate finding.
Well, so does malpractice involve a failure to practice law properly. What's the meaningful policy distinction?
This court alone determines whether something was the practice of law or not the practice of law.
All right, let's assume this went to the unauthorized practice of law board, which you admit would have jurisdiction.
Yes.
Would you argue to the board on the unauthorized practice of law that you are not violating Mid-Atlantic, or would you admit that and say there were no damages?
We would admit it and say there were no damages.
Let me follow up on that question and the ones that were asked by the Chief Justice. Let's assume that Mr. Nieves files a complaint alleging that what happened in this case, and then as a first cause of action, alleges that the way in which All-Star Title conducted its settlement or its settlements was negligent to the point that negligent because it violated the duty which springs from other sources to have a Delaware attorney present in conducting that settlement. No mention of an authorized practice. It's a negligence case that happens to be grounded on the same facts that could ground an unauthorized practice proceeding elsewhere. Why shouldn't the Superior Court be entitled to have the power to entertain that claim?
Because that's form over substance. The substance of the claim still involves the exclusive jurisdiction of this court, regardless of how it's phrased.
So are you saying that the plaintiff would have to come to this court first and prevail in an unauthorized practice proceeding and then could go to Superior Court?
The determination would have to be made as to whether something was the unauthorized practice of law or not.
Yes.
And then
let's assume then Mr. Nieves goes to initiates a proceeding before the unauthorized practice commission or committee and prevails and obtains a determination affirmed by the Supreme Court that All-Star engaged in the unauthorized practice. Can Mr. Nieves then take that determination and use it as a basis for a negligence claim for damages in the Superior Court?
It depends on what this court says he can do, because those recommendations are made by the panel as to the disposition of the matter. And whether or not, for instance, in Ray Estep, the court allowed certain civil claims to be brought. So the possibility exists there, and it was initially brought in front of
you're court. Saying the panel would have to make a recommendation regarding a damage award for the Superior Court to have jurisdiction?
I would say the board would have to make a recommendation, and this court would have to approve it.
And if that happens, then Mr. Nevis could go to the Superior Court?
Depending on the disposition recommended by the panel and accepted by this court.
The answer is yes?
It could, yes.
So it would require that roundabout procedure before any Superior Court action could be filed. But it could be filed once that's done, correct?
Under current precedent, yes.
Right. Well, let me try another variation on my earlier hypothetical. Let's suppose that someone wants to help someone out in a family court matter, and the person says, I will write your brief for the family court, and the person's not a lawyer, and you pay them $5,000 and they write this brief for you, and then you find out they're not a lawyer. You seem to indicate in response to my earlier question, you could go to a court and file a civil claim for damages to get your $5,000 back. Is that correct?
Yes.
So how is that different than your answer to all the previous questions on why this case should not go forward?
Because the determination, there's in our facts here, there must be a determination that something was or was not the unauthorized practice of law in order to supply, for instance, in that scenario, the duty requirement. But in order to supply the duty requirement for the unauthorized practice of law, it would have to go first before this court. But there, it's clear someone is saying something that is not true. He's saying that he's a lawyer or she's not a lawyer.
All right, let's assume they didn't say it. Let's assume they just said, I'll write the brief for you. And then the brief is filed, and the brief is stricken because the person who signed the brief is not a lawyer. And they never said they were a lawyer. When your brief is stricken and you have nothing on file with the court and you've paid your $5,000, you're going to be upset and you're going to say, I want my $5,000 back. Why shouldn't you be able to get your $5,000 back even if the person never told you they were a lawyer? They just simply said, I'll write your brief.
That would depend on the damages.
Well, it's the $5,000 you paid for a brief that was worthless because it was stricken.
And who determines whether it's, I'm sorry to pose questions here, but if the brief is worthless, if it doesn't win or doesn't...
Well, it didn't get considered on the merits because it was stricken because it was filed by a person who was not a member of the bar.
Well, then if it is stricken, then the $5,000 is definitely a loss.
And can you go to a civil court and recover that?
Yes, you could.
And my question is, why is that different than our case?
Because there has to be a determination that there was an unauthorized practice of law first. In that situation, it's clear that because the brief is signed by someone who is not a member of the Delaware Bar, that that's clearly not...
Well, why isn't it equally clear here after Mid-Atlantic that the settlement was conducted by an entity that was not a lawyer?
It could be, but that's a determination that this court would make by its arm, the board and the authorized practice of law.
So even if there was binding precedent on all fours with your case, making it clear that what occurred here constituted the unauthorized practice of law, there could be no civil damages claim because Mr. Nevis first had to get a determination by this court under the unauthorized practice procedures.
Yes, Your Honor.
And not only that, but would have to get a recommendation from the the panel and this court, I guess, giving them a green light to seek money damages based on that determination.
Yes, Your Honor. Just a conclusion.
Is there anything currently pending before the board on the unauthorized practice of law involving your client?
No.
Is there anything that was filed with regard to this matter that's been dismissed?
Yes.
And is the resolution public?
No.
Well, since we regulate this, it's probably accessible to us. So tell us the resolution.
There was a voluntary affidavit, and the ODC said this was fine. It went before the board itself, and it was dismissed.
I assume with the understanding your client would not do this in the future.
Correct.
And was there any payment of damages to anyone?
No.
So it was a general ruling about the practices of your client rather than involving your client's specific conduct in this case. Although this case might have generated it, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
We'll give you your full 43 seconds.
Okay.
But was your client involved in that proceeding before the unauthorized practice?
No. Our office was not, and upon information belief, my client was not as well. Specifically, we just wanted to reference the fact that the idea that we would have to file a claim before the Supreme Court first both implicates statute of limitations concerns. It also implicates class action concerns, which we have also filed. The burden on the unauthorized practice of law board to make a generally easy decision would be massive, considering the fact that, again, it's a simple decision of whether or not an attorney was there or whether he wasn't. We would further say that the benefit to non-attorneys in this case is substantial. You know, you don't have a face of responsibility, and simply put, you have no duties to do anything. There's so much duty to be communicative with a client if you're an attorney at a real estate refinance, but if you're a non-attorney, suddenly you're absolved of any duty that we've assigned with INRI member of the bar. And I don't want to go too far over my time.
Right. Well, I have one question, even though your time's up. In this case, I get the impression that the title company's position is, if you look at all of our charges on the settlement sheet as a title company, they would have been identical even if an attorney had been present. And possibly there would have been an additional charge for an attorney. But our charges are identical, whether the attorney's there or not. Therefore, there were no damages. Is that the way you understand their position?
I believe that's what they're stating, that there are no damages in the sense of that no damages were caused by the conduct. However, whether or not the value of those services, which I believe exceed what a regular attorney would be charging for that, much like Mid-Atlantic, actually coincides or disproves that statement.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Take the case under advisement, recess.